pointing temperatures 12 to 13 probably at best. Finally, onto Northern Ireland, grey and damp start here, but heavy rain awaits for the afternoon. Torrential downpours on into the evening. It'll probably take until about midnight for that to ease back. Again, some significant totals, possibly some impacts, and highs certainly not impressive for the time of year, just 12 or 13 degrees.
Thanks, Susan. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week. And matters of political reform loom large during the reign of William IV. This time, anger and tension preside. But the reform bill will eventually become law, won't it? In Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser.
On Saturday, the 29th of October, 1831, 9 days after the prorogation of Parliament, the ultra-Tory lawyer Sir Charles Wetherill set out for the West Country to perform his official functions as Recorder of Bristol. When he entered Bristol, escorted by a large force of special constables and police, he found himself amid the groans, hisses, and execrations of thousands. At Temple Street, his carriage was showered with stones and rotten eggs. The unfortunate Wetherill was screwed up in one corner, with an air of complete terror on his face. When his presence was made known, a huge and menacing group gathered round his lodging at the Mansion House. Then they proceeded to attack with bars, stones, and, of course, fire, the undiscriminating weapon of the mob down the ages. At least 100 houses were burnt, including the Bishop's Palace, the Toll House, the Excise House, the Customs House, and 3 prisons. The Mansion House itself was sacked before being burnt, and Wetherill himself only escaped, like some Mozartian character, by dressing as a postillion and fleeing over the roof. When the cooks were driven out of the kitchen, the feast they had prepared was left behind, so the rioters were able to enjoy turtle soup, turkeys, and joints of venison. Some fell to the ground blind drunk and were consumed by the fire they had created. The official estimate was of 12 killed and just under 100 wounded in the course of a battle which started from the moment of Wetherill's appearance, when he was greeted by cries of "The King and Reform!" and "We'll give them reaction!" 102 prisoners were taken, 81 convicted, 31 of them of capital crimes. 4 were executed and 7 men transported overseas. It was all very well for the Whig government to take the position that the violence would end when reform was carried. For all anyone knew at the beginning of November, the revolution predicted by both sides, notably by the Duke of Wellington, was on its way. The great estates took precautions. At Beaver Castle, home of the Tory Duke of Rutland, cannons and one long gun were set up on the northeast terrace, which was specially paved for their reception. Guy Fawkes Day fell a few days later. In Exeter, Bishop Henry Philpotts was already a target by reason of his notoriously anti-reform stance. Now his effigy was ostentatiously burnt. Nearer home, the Duke of Wellington himself, together with the Duke of Cumberland, was burnt in effigy at Tyburn near Marble Arch. In a leader on the day of the opening of Parliament, The Times expressed hope that His Majesty would mention the dreadful occurrences at Bristol. They were satisfied. Putting on his spectacles to read his speech from the throne, William IV sounded shocked by recent events. "My lords and gentlemen, the scenes of violence and outrage which have occurred in the city of Bristol have caused me the deepest affliction. Therefore, foremost in the coming session, the King wanted a speedy consideration of the measures of reform in the House of Commons." Lord John Russell presented the new bill on the 12th of December after it had been debated. On the 17th of December, the House of Commons once again passed the bill. However, it seemed inevitable that the Lords would reject the bill, in clear defiance of the popular will. The strain of these weeks was beginning to tell on all the Whigs in government. It was Lord Althorp who showed real signs of cracking. As leader of the House of Commons, he was suffering from working all day and often all night. There was a troubling incident when he was found locking away his pistols for fear of having too easy access to them in a moment of madness. "I do not know whether I might not, to make matters easier, shoot myself," he told Sir John Hobhouse. "For God's sake, shoot anybody else you like," replied Hobhouse. As anticipated and feared, on the 7th of May 1832, the government was defeated in the Lords by a majority of 45. On the same day, before news of the defeat of the Reformers' cherished hopes could reach Birmingham, the biggest public meeting yet took place at Newell Hill under Thomas Attwood's presidency. Representatives of 30 other unions from the Midlands were invited to take part. Fortunately, for the guardians of public order, there was to be no repetition of Bristol. Tuesday, the 8th of May, was a day of ferment in political circles. Rising to his feet in the House of Lords, the former Prime Minister made the announcement which everyone was awaiting. "The King was graciously pleased to accept our resignation." Lord Grey and his government were therefore holding office only until their successors were appointed. It was on the 9th of May that King William asked the Duke of Wellington to form a new administration. In the same breath, it was made clear that the Duke was expected to bring sufficient measures of reform to satisfy the country. In his political naivety, the King didn't seem to understand the extraordinary difficulties, both moral and practical, inherent in his demand. Officially, while Wellington struggled with his paradoxical task, Britain was without a government, though the previous incumbents would continue to administrate, with Lord Grey still residing in Downing Street. But for a final parting, it was necessary to secure the acceptance of office by a fresh lot of ministers, and that was where the intrigues were now centred. Not all the negotiations were with the Tories. Brougham was privately asked by King William to continue as Lord Chancellor. He declined. The King wept, but Brougham refused to give way. The country was in a state of uproar. During these 2 days, people talked openly of civil war, according to Edward Littleton. There was even talk of a change of dynasty. "I never heard the like before," he wrote. The King actually found himself being driven through a hissing crowd on his return from Windsor on the 12th of May. Wellington declared himself as ready to do whatever the King might command him to do. "I am as much averse to the reform as ever I was," he declared. But no private consideration would prevent him from making every effort to serve the King. That included forming a government, if he was asked to do so. It was on Saturday, the 12th of May, that the decision was made in London among the Radicals, led by Francis Place, to attack the soft belly of any government, the finances of the country. The meeting, held at his house on the 12th, decided the best way of defeating the Duke was to cause a run on the banks. Joseph Parkes then got to work drawing up a placard. "To stop the Duke, go for gold." The printer offered to work all night, and by Sunday morning, bill stickers saw to it that bills were posted all over London. Further parcels of posters were sent off that evening and the next day by coach to every quarter of England and Scotland. Thus, Monday the 14th of May, a week after the double crisis day, dawned with revolution in the air. Calls for political action, posters everywhere, a run on the banks commencing. and no government as yet in place. The mood of the House on the 14th of May, with its Whig majority, was one of disgust. As Ebrington put it, the Tories, having opposed the Reform Bill in its principle and details, were nevertheless ready to accept office with the view of carrying out the very measure they had strenuously resisted. However, Sir Robert Peel, the Tory leader in the Commons, would inform the House that he wasn't able to accept office. He acted on principle when he declared, "I feel unable to enter into the service of the Crown." There can be little question that it was his refusal which proved fatal to the Tory interest. On the 15th of May, Wellington decided to abandon his attempt to serve his sovereign as impractical, since he had no hope of controlling the Commons. The Morning Chronicle pronounced that the debate in the House of Lords had been an open declaration of war against the people of England. Now rumours of Wellington's withdrawal spread rapidly. Finally, the King agreed that if there were continuing obstacles to the bill, Lord Grey might submit to him a creation of peers sufficient to carry the bill. The next day, the 19th of May, Lord Grey was discussing with the King's private secretary, Sir Herbert Taylor, the technicalities of reinstating ministers whose resignations had been accepted. So the Prime Minister, as Grey could be described once more, sent for Thomas Attwood. Already the reformer's hero of the hour was being feted, and now he met Grey with Lord Holland at the Treasury. Grey was handsome in his acknowledgement of Attwood's role. "We owe our situation entirely to you." The Times was able to salute the imagined sentiments of the King with a merry rhyme, which it dedicated to that patriotic figure, John Bull. "Return, Lord Grey, I prithee return to me. Return, Lord Grey, and bring the people with thee. Too much Duke, I find, won't do, Lord Grey. Too much Duke has turned my people away. My spouse shall dance, and I will sing, since Dukey is driven away, for I'm sure I've done the wisest thing I've done for many a day." The event, so long desired, so long dreaded, finally took place on the 4th of June, 1832, and the Reform Bill was passed with a majority of 84. "Thank God," wrote Creevey, who was present. When the new House of Commons met for the first time, it was gratifying to all reformers that the result was a large Whig majority. And as Russell pointed out, everyone was discovering that they had been reformers all along. At the time of the Royal Assent, on 7th of June, Sir John Hobhouse summed it up: "Thus ends this great national exploit. The deed is done. It is difficult to believe that it is done." It was indeed a great national exploit. If the deed was not done forever, it was, at the very least, a great beginning.
Adrian Scarborough was reading from Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser. It was abridged by Catherine William, and the series producer was Duncan Minchell. And you can hear Antonia Fraser discuss her book on Start the Week here on Radio 4 from 9 o'clock on Monday morning. This is BBC Radio 4, and now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 18th of May. The general synopsis at 1800. High southeast Iceland, 1025, moves away northeastwards by 1800 Saturday. New lows expected Irish Sea and Tyne, both 1004 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking north at Sierra, south at Sierra, 40s, Cromarty, 4th. Northerly or northeasterly, 5 or 6. Occasionally 7 for a time in Cromarty and 4th. Rain or showers, fog patches, but fog banks in 40s, Cromarty and 4th. Moderate or poor, occasionally very poor. Tyne Dogger, north 5 or 6. Occasionally 7 at first in Tyne, becoming cyclonic 4 or 5. Occasional rain, fog banks, moderate